Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are right now. You're a part of Israel. So thank you so much for joining us, and thank you to Rabbi Mike Foyer for joining us yet again.
Oh, shalom, Yishai. It's good to see you.
Shalom, Rabbi Mike, and shalom to the Pardes Institute. Shalom to Yerushalayim on this glorious, that's the right word in English anyway for today. It's a glorious day. It rained a lot in the beginning of the week, and it's just crystal beautiful. The mountains of Moab, the beautiful lit up city of Jerusalem, shining city on a hill there, and just Gewalt.
Gewalt.
It's just an awesome, beautiful day.
That's all that can be said.
That's right. And thank you very much to the Land of Israel Network for hosting our show here today. I have to tell you, Rabbi Mike, I am super psyched to be here with you today for this week's Torah portion. I'm just, this year, more than any other year so far, I'm psyched about this week's Torah portion.
You're feeling moved by the law.
That's right. I am enamored with this codex. Codec. Codex is from the audio world. This is which one is it? No, it's the other way. This is codex. Codec is from the audio.
Codec
world, right?
Is the camera.
No, codec. Codec is like when you. It's a different. It's an audio term.
Okay,
it doesn't
matter.
I trust
you on that one.
Yeah, but codex is what we're dealing with here. This is like the Code of Hammurabi. We're dealing with the law.
Yeah, it's like the Code of Hammurabi passed through a divine moral lens.
That's right.
Right, and that's why many people...
Should I say this correctly? But not too divine, meaning to say it's a very reasonable, super reasonable human law.
Well,
here.
That's why I use those two words, divine moral lens, meaning one could say that Hammurabi's code was the sort of absolute human sort of despotism of the power of humanity. And one could say that when Christianity stripped away the law altogether, right, it was reaching for a sort of like a divine absolute love morality. And the power of the Torah is such that it's able to combine sort of the awe and the love together with a very detailed understanding of sort of human psychology and behavior and really embody holiness in the world. That's right. What this parsha is about, is how do you embody holiness in the world through your every action, as opposed to just leaving it to some sort of like city on a hill, as you said before.
Right, right. Okay, so there is holiness here, but I guess another part of my brain, which is enamored with this week's Torah portion,
the lawyer in you,
it's the legal side, and it's also actually something that you haven't said yet, which I'm sure you'll agree with, which is fairness, like fairness in human dealings, and then also the beauty of complexity, the beauty that, like, you know, the there's this, you know what it is, here's another, I hate to harp on this, but this is another Jordan Peterson moment, which I had an aha moment. He said, we are not just our bodies. There's things that extend our bodies out more. For example, our car. Mm-hmm. Our car is an extension of our body.
Possessions in general could be looked
right
at that way.
And right, a car is a good example because it's this big, expensive thing. It's very powerful. But you are the brain within that machine. Mm-hmm. And also, if somebody scratches it, it hurts you. If you hurt somebody with it, you've done
you are
a bad.
Liable, right.
Right. And what I realized is a lot of this Torah portion, the tort law behind this, is also really the extension of your actions and your responsibility for them, the extension of you. So, for example, we'll get to that just a little bit. You light a fire in your house, but a wind blows.
Right.
And it takes the fire out. Well, if it takes the fire outside of your property and then burns somebody else's thing.
You say, I didn't do it.
I didn't do it.
Right.
Okay, but did you take the necessary precautions? Because you have a brain, you're a controller, or an animal that gores. Okay, did this animal gore a few times? Were you warned? Now you killed somebody. Wait a minute. Now you are liable. Okay, if it killed the first time, well, that's just crazy, you know, that happened. But if you knew and you didn't take steps, so suddenly the you is a lot broader.
Yes, and it's really an embedding of the individual in context, the context of their possessions, the context of society. And because of that, I mean, that word fairness is interesting. As a parent, my antenna went up there when you said fairness, because I'm constantly telling my kids, you know, this whole notion that fair means the same is a big mistake. It's right. It's common. I don't know how your kids, my kids will commonly say, well, he got this, she got that. That's not fair. And what I always try to say to them is, well, fair doesn't mean everyone gets the same. Fair means everyone gets what they need. Right? Or
okay.
what they deserve.
You're contextualizing what fairness means.
Right.
But what I'm talking about here is, and I think that we all know this basically, which is just, it's a basic justice, but it's a basic It's fairness. You know, it's not fairness and equality. It's not that's a childish way of understanding fairness.
Well, for example, not just childish. Example, I mean, it's a major force in human society.
Okay, but you were
defines
born,
fairness as equal.
Let's say somebody was born, God forbid, with some kind of physical limitation. P.S. By the way, I have one physical limitation. According to the Israeli army, I have a lesser
value. To the military.
I am a less rated person because I'm colorblind.
That's right.
And in fact, they're right. It is a disability.
But your fashion sense makes up for it.
That's right. That's right. I keep it simple. That's why. But I have a disability. Is that fair? Is that fair, God? That might not be fair. I'm not equal.
No,
to
I'm not
other
talking
people.
About the divine perspective. I'm talking about the legal perspective. Because the reality is that if you have a disability, there is a social question: does society have an obligation to equalize?
Right.
Do we need to create parking spaces for you? Should we have different color traffic lights?
Yeah.
You know, and that is a major. You can't just dismiss fair as equal. It's a tremendous element in Western jurisprudence and general human culture. The whole communist worldview, you know, and like, you know, from everyone according to their need to each according to their. Sorry, flip that. From each according to their ability to each according to their need is a notion of. The sort of like division.
Right. But tort law, which is also a lot of the stuff is really the common today's, you know,
oh, yes.
You read it in common law and tort law is an amazing body of law. And it really, what I mean to say, fairness is like, you are protected. There is a reasonable understanding about where your actions may lead.
Well, I'm waiting for the piece that you haven't said, which is there is an agreed upon standard of measure
right.
for justice.
Right.
And that to me is why it's so important that Parshat Mishpatim, this week's Parsha, it comes right on the heels of Mamad Har Sinai, the revelation at Sinai. It's not just because, of course, in a narrative sense, that's what was happening. Like Moshe came down with chapter headings on those stones, and then so God begins to articulate to him the whole process. It's also because it's so easy to divide those two. There's God on the mountain in the fire and the light show, and then there's civil court. And so the Torah's answer to that is no. Without God on the mountain in the light show, civil court goes off the rails right away. Right, there is no standard by which justice can be expressed mm-hmm. in the world, mm-hmm. and that's that. I guess what was bugging me is that I don't actually see this childish and sometimes, you know, held up by whole societies and civilizations notion of fairness as an adequate substitute for a sense of justice in it with capital J. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for capital J.
Okay. You know what? Let's play out these slightly different positions. As we go through the laws, because these are laws, let's all get on the same chapter. Literally, we're talking about chapter 21 in the book of Exodus. Okay, and again, I know I'm sounding a little repetitive. That's okay.
So we do this every year.
Yeah, we do that, right. No, but the repetitive aspect of we have entered now into a revolutionary moment in terms of the Torah and as a text. Suddenly, we're entering into real law. We're going to get later on to the harder Torah portions. There's also blueprint Torah portions, which I find to be very hard, and I've been studying it with my son this year. And then there's also Korbanot, blueprint Torah, the offerings. And then there's the toughest one of them all, which is skin lesions. And
I knew it was coming.
Right, those are the hardest.
We've got time to prepare.
This one is actually not so hard, and it's very, very very understandable because these are common tort laws.
Exactly. It's clearly necessary. A person reads it, you may disagree or not with the particular expressions, but everybody agrees this law we need.
Right. And you said something just a minute ago. You connected it to the Torah portions of right before Jethro, Yitro, where we learn about the Sinaitic experience. Okay. But Rashi makes another connection there. He says right at the very end of last week's Torah portion, we talked about the tabernacle mm-hmm. and the altar.
Not
specifically,
the tabernacle.
Yeah, right.
The altar and the ramp that goes up the altar.
The word altar is one of those few words. I have about 10, 15 words that like
just doesn't
stick.
They
will not pop into my brain. I don't know. Maybe I don't like the word altar. I don't know. Maybe I'm afraid of marriage. No, just that's not it. That's not it. Just joking.
Talk about that with Malkin.
Okay. Oh no, Freudian thing. Anyway, so he says, well, it's because the Sanhedrin, the body of supreme law adjudicators in the land of Israel is meant to sit at the temple, close to the end of Temple Mount, close to the
altar. Right.
The altar. There's a separation of powers on some level, different jobs, but they got to be real close. Just like you were saying, the judgment has got to be woven through
with the divine.
With the divine.
I mean, you know that the Sanhedrin actually sat in a room called the Court of Hewn Stones, which was half in the Kodesh and half in the Chol.
Right.
It was half in the sacred precinct and half in the mundane precinct. And the altar, of course, is that which connects heaven and earth. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's consistent, the placement of the altar between the experience of Sinai and the articulation of all these laws.
There's no way we're going to be able to have time to go through all of the laws. No way at all. And understand that humongous tractates.
Huge tracts of law.
Tracts of law are written over phrases.
I want someone to send me an email if they get the reference.
Which one?
Huge tracts of land.
Where's that?
No, I'm not going to tell you now. I don't know. Someone send me an email.
Okay. Right. Okay, good. Okay, somebody's got to get that. Okay, and that's Rev Mike at thelandofisrael.com. I'm going to start with the first law that I want to discuss, which is if a slave, a Hebrew slave, decides that he wants to be, continue to be, I prefer the word servant, by the way, but okay.
The word is slave.
The word is slave, fine. Sometimes you just, like, I try to liberalize things and you, like, come like a hammer, okay? No, here's the thing. This slave wants to stay a slave to this family. He likes the family. He likes the work. He feels comfortable in that position.
Yeah, I mean, also he likely was sold into slavery because he, in the context, according to our sages, because he stole in his poverty, meaning, like, there is to a certain degree a good life to be taken care of there.
Right. You're being taken care of, and you know what you're doing. And if anybody's ever been in some kind of situation like that, a similar situation is the army. When you're in the army, you're like an indentured servant.
Oh, yes, okay? You definitely are.
And there is amazing relief at not having to make too many decisions, knowing what your job is and knowing what you're doing. But the Torah looks at it in a very special way. It says, okay, fine. You have to bring him to the courts of law, and they have to bring him to the door, to the mezuzah, to the
doorpost.
And they've got a, there's a certain English word. What's the English word? They take a what?
They puncture his ear with an awl.
Oh, how do you spell that?
A-W-L.
Wow.
All. If you're from New York, it's all.
What's up, y'all? Okay, so right, with my coffee. I'll have it in my coffee. Right. Anyway, you take an all and you puncture his ear through to the doorpost. And Rashi says, this is so that this person who heard, his ear heard, or his forefathers heard, that you're supposed to be a servant to me, and not supposed to be a servant to anybody else. That's, you know, that the signal is that you somehow reneged on that.
Right. Remember, the phrase is you were servant to me and not servant to servants.
Right. Not servant to servants.
Right, and that's a very important formulation, right? Especially when you look at it, and it comes right at the beginning of this whole codex of laws, you called it. And I think it's an important assertion, is that the law is not meant to substitute for servitude to God, right? You can easily, you know, the Kutzker used to say that the Chassid serves God and the Misnagdid serves the Shulchan Aruch, right? So there is a danger with law in making it what you serve. And part of what's happening here is almost a poetic expression of the fact that the law is the way in which you serve God. Don't lose sight of that. In the same way, okay, you want to be a servant because that's the posture you've taken in the world? Well, be a servant to God. Don't be a servant to servants, because everybody's a servant to God.
Right. And also, as a Jew, like, strive for freedom and strive to also be responsible. I want you to have responsibility. But okay, but there's a place for what you're doing, but there'll be an outward sign of it.
Yes. You're marking yourself as having basically stepped away from the fulfillment of the ultimate human potential, which is to freely serve God.
Right. Okay. And then Rashi adds one more. It says, I'll take you to the doorpost because those doorposts were witnesses of the blood that I put in so that I would jump over those houses. And again, say, the children of Israel are my servants and not, as you said, servants of servants. So there's really two things, though. The ear that heard, the doorpost that saw. Okay, you're skipping out on that. So that's one thing. So okay, I guess for us, we could also learn a little bit non-tort law. We could learn, like, okay, you know, like yesterday I had a moment where I was doubted my decision.
Uh-oh.
Some decision happens to me every day, okay, where I'm like, you idiot.
What did you do?
Right. And I was in Hebron.
Oddly enough.
Yeah, it was great. And I looked into a, I just passed next to a car. I didn't like look into a car, but I like passed next to a car and I saw inside that they had a sticker on the dash not like on the right, on the glove compartment, and it said, "Kacha Hashem rotze." Such has, thusly does
thus
God want.
God desires. <That's
right>. And I, you know what? I bless the people who make stickers like that.
Yeah, I know.
And I was just like, that's great. That's just a great, you know what? It came in just
except
at the right
when they
time.
Cut you off in front of you. Like, right. It's on the bumper. It's like, that's yeah. What God wants. You're like, no, it isn't.
Did you ever see that meme where you see the guy, there's like a Jaguar and has the license plate Mohel? And then the tagline is, that guy, that's the second time that guy cut me off.
Oh, no, I saw it coming. Oh.
Oh, Gevalt. Good one.
Oh,
good
bad.
Joke. Okay.
Anyway.
Let's go on.
You were, made it, you were doubting your decision.
Yeah. And then I saw this thing.
Oh, that's I understand.
That's what God wants.
All right. I'm like,
listen, you know what? That's good.
It's true. I mean, the whole world is speaking to you in the voice of God.
Amen. Especially in those nice Jewish stickers with a beautiful Hebrew phrase. Thus did God want. Okay, next one is you could buy a father can sell, so to speak, his daughter for marriage, right?
So it begins as servitude with the intention of marriage.
Right. Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you very much. So servitude, meaning to say these are probably poverty-stricken people, and he's allowed to put his daughter into servitude, but there's money exchanged there.
For sure.
Right, and then the idea is that when this girl grows up,
that money becomes what's called kesef kiddushin. It actually becomes the effective transfer of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, you don't actually have to do another kiddushin ceremony.
However, in this case, this is very, very interesting stuff. However, in this case, the master is not smitten with this young girl, and he wants to. He wants to get rid of her.
Right.
He doesn't want her. Well, he cannot do that. He can transfer that ownership and that right
that
to his son.
Marriage, right.
Right, to his son. But he can't just get rid of her, just throw her out.
Willy-nilly.
Right. He has to what? He cannot. Here's the important line. I want to get everything right here, so help me out. Okay. He can't. It says if she's bad in his eyes, he cannot throw her out and give her away to somebody else or to a foreigner. He cannot control her to sell her in his bigdo. What's it called? Bigdo is
to betray her.
Betray in his betrayal. He cannot mistreat her in betrayal. Right. He can't just now that he. Why am I talking about this law?
I was actually kind of wondering that.
Here's why. Here's because I'll tell you why. Because I actually think that these verses... Did I explain it right? Can you add anything on the legal side?
No, I think you're okay.
Okay. The reason I wanted to say is because to me, I always saw this verse in a different way. This is a verse about God and the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you took us into servitude for you. But we may not be always very pleasing.
We weren't exactly what you thought.
Right. So it says, "Im ra'a b'nei Adonai," if we look bad in the eyes of God, "asher lo yada," and look that there's the famous one of the few places that there's a lamed aleph, which is low, but it's spelled lamed vav,
mm-hmm.
which was intended for him. Like when he turns away from us,
just sell us to the non-Jews.
To the non-Jews, you right. Can't. You got to be with us, God. Even when in our fallen state, you got to be with us. Even if we've turned away from you and you've turned away from us. Like, you made a deal to take us in. You made a deal to take us in, so you can't just...
That's very interesting. I might take that one further in my work, because this also happens to be the whole section in which we learn the basic obligations of a husband to wife in marriage.
Right.
Which I use when I teach young men who are preparing for marriage, when I teach chatanim, right? This idea that it says that it defines what's called mishpat habanot. Yaselah, right? No, you have to do the proper justice toward women, which is right. Sherak sutava onata, right? The three obligations within the marital contract are: you must feed, you must sustain, and you know, give a sense of security and safety, right? You have to give a sense of dignity as represented by clothing, and there has to be intimacy and like devoted physical, emotional, time, logistical intimacy, right? And that those three together really define what a marriage is.
And those are things that the husband owes the wife. This is revolutionary.
Right. Those are the obligations. The definition of, even because the context here is that even if he sort of like marries her off to his son and then his son already has a wife, et cetera, you cannot take these things away. Otherwise, she goes free because it breaks the nature of the relationship.
That's the missing thing that I didn't say. That was the missing component that I didn't say in the legal side, which is she goes free. You cannot sell her if you don't want her.
Right.
You cannot mistreat her. You can't take her as a second wife and then not give her those three things.
Right, because she wasn't, like you were saying with Amiso, she wasn't taken as a servant. She was taken with the intention of a real relationship.
Right.
It's just because of the social context we're speaking about here, that she began as a servant.
Right.
And but the same way began that way coming out of Egypt.
Right.
It was only once we built the temple and there was, a real home that we could share, that there was an opportunity for the fullness of a relationship.
But it doesn't exactly say that she goes free, right? That's the understanding. But the point
sure
is,
it does.
Which word is it? The hevda?
Im shlosha ela lo yasela v'yatzachinam
im kasa. Right. I mean, say in the previous verse that I was learning, it doesn't say to say don't turn away from her. Right,
right, right.
Don't, you can't give her away to a foreign nation when you sell them, when you turn away from them. Okay.
Right.
All right. But you're added. That's exactly what I was looking for, which is they added, like, in fact, if he doesn't give her those three things, he, the bottom line is he can't mistreat her. He got her as a servant girl. She was supposed to become a wife. Okay. Didn't happen. Set her free. Okay. Yep. She's got her own life to live. Okay. Next law that I wanted to talk about, the sets of laws that are about the difference between, such an important difference, ladies and gentlemen, the difference between murder and killing in its various degrees, mm-hmm. what they call in America manslaughter. Okay,
right.
the various degrees of that. Okay, so for example, if you hit somebody and you kill him, okay, you're going to die as well. But if you didn't, it wasn't malice intent,
or it wasn't murderous intent.
Right, it wasn't murderous intent. Like,
there's a difference between a malice intent and a murderous intent.
Right.
If I might have had the full intent to hit you with this big stick and teach you a lesson, I just wasn't looking to kill you.
Right.
The fact that I hit you too hard or in a soft spot. You know.
Right. And Rashi will give a few tough examples. For example, a emissary of the court of law who is got the right to administer 40 lashes.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what?
On the 38th, the guy breaks.
The guy goes down.
Right.
You didn't know that he was, okay, that it's normal to give 40 lashes.
Right.
And somehow this person died, God forbid. Or a father, God forbid, this is the worst, who wants to teach a son some way, he wants to give him a smack, somehow that causes death. Oh my gosh. Or a teacher. I'm wondering why he brought the father and the teacher. But okay, fine.
Right.
Okay, these are obviously situations where there was not an intent to kill, but there was an intent to strike.
Right.
Okay, so then God says, the Torah says, other than payments, there's also this idea of running towards city of refuge, which is first introduced here.
Right, it's our first mention. We're going to get several more treatments of it in the
right.
Torah. It's very interesting in my eyes that how many times the Torah brings up this idea of the cities of refuge.
Right.
And I think it tells us a couple of things. First of all, that the Israelites were a hot-blooded people. You know, the idea of blood guilt and redeeming blood guilt was obviously quite present in the culture.
Doesn't sound very liberal and peaceful.
But it also tells us that the general approach of the Torah to change is educational evolutionary, not sort of mandatory revolutionary.
Before you get to evolutionary, you talked about a certain hot-bloodedness.
Yeah.
It's a Middle East people in a Middle East country.
Yeah, but the Torah's intention was to change that.
Yes. Okay,
that's
fine.
My point.
Right.
And rather than trying to do it through mandate of, like, don't do this anymore, that's it, revolution, the Torah has a much deeper understanding of the human experience and does it through this educational evolutionary.
Right.
Which is, I'm going to create these cities. You're going to be able to run refuge. By the way, if the Redeemer of Blood catches you first, you're going down.
Right.
Right? You know, and an attempt to shift society toward an embodiment of more sacred values of life.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the hot-bloodedness there is something which is accepted as a reality but rejected as an ideal.
There's also when somebody grabs on to the altar, right?
Just checking.
Somebody grabs onto the altar, and that's like a safe space, a refuge.
Mm-hmm.
But if he murders, you can take him out of that refuge. He cannot ali oxen free on
right, free base.
Right, he can't hold on to the corners of the Mizbeach, and we had a few cases of that. Yoav, I think Adonia as well, right? These folks like
that. I don't think Adonia made it there. Did he make it there?
I don't remember. But the point is that there are some folks in this. They use this like, don't, you can't kill me because I'm holding on to this
magic safe base,
right? And there is, that means that there is a magic safe base, but not for these things.
You can run, but you can't hide.
Okay, we have then let's see what I want. There's a lot, but I'm going to just... An interesting thing is somebody who curses their father and mother is also to be put to death.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
I've tried to bring this one up in my house before. It doesn't really go so well.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. I mean, what does it say to you? Like, why would the... I mean, I think that most societies can understand why murder would be punishable by death. And I think that you know, sort of like the think of sexual violations that were being discussed being punishable by death. That might be a debate, but we could all understand why. But why do you think that the Torah would mandate death for cursing one's parents?
You know, first thing, I'm not sure if this ever actually happened.
Adjudicated
like that, and there's a whole warning system and all that that has to come
okay,
in.
Okay, but the question of whether it was put into action is a secondary question.
I think it's because it is itself a kind of death within society. It is a cutting between generations. It's something that basically bespeaks of a certain kind of death, which you don't see the continuum. And we've learned that the honoring of the father and the mother are on par with a relationship with God. It's a type of idolatry. It's a type of it's a violence. It's a violence that's done, and it in itself is something that probably can spread as a mental type virus, and an atmosphere. Remember the 60s. Don't trust anybody over 30. That kind of thing. Just today, I had an important meeting with somebody, and I said to this person, that's why I was late here today, and I said to this person, look, you're the elder statesman of this issue. I try not to use the word old. I say, you're the senior staff, I said, on this issue. Me and my friends are a generation behind you. I want to be part of what you're doing. I'm not trying to revolt against what you're doing. I literally had to say that, mm-hmm. and I could see that she understood that I really meant what I'm trying to say, that I'm trying to come in and support what you've done and keep it going, as opposed to saying, look,
get out of the way, lady.
Right, get out of the way, right.
Yeah, well, and part of what I hear you saying and needs to be brought out is that the Torah's assumption is that society is the sort of prime element of measure and not the individual. And so, therefore, the idea of cursing one's parents undermines the social fabric in a way which is disastrous. You know, and as you said, it may not be murder in the same way as picking up a gun and shooting someone, but it does destroy people's lives mm-hmm. in the long run,
yep.
which is a hard thing for us in a Western individualistic society to really take seriously. So, kind of on a certain level, it's like, well, sticks and stones don't... You may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. That whole idea that many of us were raised with is the diametric opposite of the Torah. What are you talking about? Words create reality,
mm-hmm.
right? And anyone who's a parent out there knows that siblings do as much, if not more, damage to each other with their words than they do with
yeah.
their hands.
Yeah,
and the hands, frankly, heal faster.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It's definitely true. It's these are big things, and really trying to teach peace amongst siblings and between parents and. And sometimes, you know, kids fly into rages and they're out of control. And to help them come out of that is like an art. It's an art. And you really, I wish, my sister-in-law, for example, is always reading books about child rearing and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so
my wife, God bless her.
You know, I tell you, man, really, seriously, there should be more public classes about these things.
There are quite a bit.
Yeah, there's quite a bit today. Right. There's today, but like, I almost feel like this should be much more like you teach Chatan Kala classes.
Yeah.
But is there, and that's kind of mandatory in our world,
right?
You know? Is there a basic guide to parenting
for women? There's an amazing rabbitzin here in Yerushalayim, Rabbitzin mm-hmm. Spetner, who does indeed do that, and she's mm-hmm. been mandated by some of the great Torah sages of our generation that she must do it, even in English, because the mm-hmm. perception is that there's a real need for that here in Jerusalem. But I would say one of the most important lessons that we learn in terms of cursing parents is that the obligation of a parent in that situation is to forgive their child.
Right.
Right. Because you want to make sure that you don't create a situation where your child is actually, God forbid, doing
right.
a sin on that level of death.
But you know what? Let's slip out of the issue of cursing parents, because that's a hard issue, and we hope
never.
But you know what? I'll give you an example that does happen in the Jewish world a lot, and that is that your son is a doctor. Right? He's a dentist.
Right.
And I got this horrible toothache. Well, it's not so simple, because the Torah teaches us that a child is not allowed to draw blood mm-hmm. from a parent. Mm-hmm. So there are many situations where the rabbis will say, no, go to a different dentist.
Right.
Okay, because we have this problem. And that's a common problem. That is a recurring theme. Okay, if you're a doctor, there's a likelihood that your parents are gonna, you know,
they're gonna want something.
They're gonna want some, you know, free consultation. Okay, did I tell you the joke about the? I think I told you last week. Come on, about the.
We have to give me more. We gotta give more to go
the,
on.
The guy's getting sworn in as the president of the United States.
You didn't say it last week, but I know the joke.
You know, there's an old lady sitting in the front, and she leans over to the guy, and she's got the scowl. What's the word? Like a frown on.
Yeah.
And she leans over to the guy next to her. She's in the front row. She looks at him, and she looks at this guy being sworn in. She says the guy next to her. She says, "You see that guy? His brother's a doctor." Okay.
Oh.
Okay. Okay. Great jokes. Okay. Let's keep going. And look at that. Isn't that funny? Look at that. What a connection. There is somebody gets hit and he doesn't die. And then he finally, after a few days, he may have fallen into some kind of coma or inability to work, but he gets up and he starts to work again. Okay. So the guy who hit him has to pay the cost of healing or any embarrassment, another few different costs. And then he also has the right to go to a doctor and say, I'm not going to bandage myself. I need you to pay the cost for the doctoring, mm-hmm. which is very common today. And the sages learn that this also means that this actually teaches us that doctors have a right to heal. The yeah. right to heal comes from this idea, because you might have thought in a different way. I know today, in our Western mindset, that doesn't really make sense. But hey, you know, there's a question like, are you allowed to heal things? Do you have the power to heal things? What gives you the right to be some kind of technician of healing? Isn't God the healer?
Right. I mean, it's part of a larger framework of religious fatalism. I mean, like, well, if whatever happens to you comes from God, which is a general principle on which the Torah operates, then maybe you should only ever work on accepting it rather than changing it, right? And there's a real tension there, not to mention the fact that, you know, like the Gemara says, like, Tova Rofim Legehenim, right? It's how things change, right?
Which
like,
is what?
Which, oh, sorry, right? Like, the best of doctors is going to hell.
see how culture
changes.
It's funny you say that, because I was just telling yesterday, I told Uri Karzen, who's the director general of Chevron, and also an avid listener to the show, thank you very much. I told him yesterday, I think what that phrase is today is, Tova politikaim legehenom, right? Even the best of the politicians are going to hell.
Yeah, well, I mean, they share something, which is they're both trying to change the world.
Right.
The doctor is focused on the, you know, particular body in front of them, and the politician is focused on the body politic. And part of the problem is the reason that they're going to hell is that it's an inexact science, and there's always a question which lurks behind it, which is, shouldn't you let this take its course if it's the will of God?
Right.
Right. So, I mean, our politics is going to take its course no matter what. Thank God doctors have refined their tools beyond that the politicians can
achieve. But doctors do go to hell sometimes, because they sometimes they say inappropriate things, like, I think he's got this and this much time to live. Like, you could say that, but you have to be careful not to say that in a fatalistic way. The other day you were waxing rhapsodic and angry about meteorologists.
Yes.
Okay, that's a pet peeve of yours.
It's the
people
rankest
don't know.
Form of heresy.
but even a tougher one. Okay, but you know that the prognostications of the weathermen and women are not always accurate. But when a doctor says to you, "You have 48 hours to live,"
people believe it.
People believe that. It's a very, you know, it's a very dangerous moment. Or to me, one of the great feeling that I have when I walk into a doctor's office is when they have that prayer of the doctor that says, you know, that's the Rambam's prayer of the doctor, when they say, okay, you know, God, I'm your servant. Or when a doctor will say to you, like, look, I'm doing my part, but God is going to heal you. I love those little phrases. They make a difference to me. Mm-hmm. They make a difference to me when I feel like this person has Yirat Shamayim. He's going to do his best, but God is going to do his, you know, his act. So those little things. On the other hand, I want the guy to be the maximally best doctor
competence.
Possible.
Yeah, there's a tension. That's what I meant when I said that it's expressive of a tension that underlies all human life. So on one hand, we must have agency, and because we must have agency, we want competency and even mastery. On the other hand, we don't want that at the expense of pushing God out of our lives.
Right, right. Well, that goes right back to tort law and mm-hmm. the divine. Okay, now we get to the famous set of phrases that say, let's read it. It's chapter 21, verse 24. In the book of Exodus, ein tachat ein, an eye for an eye, or an eye under an eye, shen tachat shen, a tooth for a tooth, yad tachat yad, a hand beneath a hand, regel tachat regel, a foot, a leg for a leg. Then it says, kviyat tachat, people don't know this, kviyat tachat kviyat, burn for a burn, petza tachat Patsa, right? A wound for a wound, chabura tachat chabura, like a dry wound for a dry wound.
Bruise.
Bruise, thank you. So I mentioned this a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, I think I mentioned to you that Gandhi said an eye for an eye will only make the world blind, the whole world blind. And then you said, very interestingly, that really made me think, I've been thinking about this for the last 2 weeks, you're like, well, that's exactly what the rabbis say, which is not really it's an eye for an eye. It's actually not to blind the other person out. It's actually...
Right, but it wasn't for the same reason that Gandhi said.
Right, okay, so that's my other side, which is still, A, don't have the chutzpah, like don't take a biblical verse and show its, you know, and make light
its
of it. That's number one,
right?
Two, wait a minute. An eye for an eye also means that there is justice.
That's what the sages saw.
Right. There is, like, if somebody takes out your eye, there will be either recompense or punishment or the various forms.
Yeah, but it's not just the idea of recompense and punishment. And here's where your notion of fairness really is quite strongly expressed. It's equivalent. Eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. You know, you need to somehow exact justice.
Right.
And that's what...
Oh, that's interesting. I never understood that. Exact also means from the word...
Precise, for
sure.
Oh,
okay.
And this is what empowered the sages in reading this to ask a question, which is that, well, is that really possible? Right? You know, if God forbid you put out my eye and the Torah says, okay, well, your turn, Yishai. So we have to start asking the questions you're asking. How about how much it hurts? What if I'm a...
What about the shame of it?
What, the shame
what
of
about
it?
My work
what,
abilities?
Right, what if I'm a, I don't know, a surgeon and you are, I don't know, a landscaper, right? So like the depth perception there might not be as valuable, et cetera, et cetera. So the sages said there's it can't be that the Torah literally means to put out someone else's eye because that wouldn't be exact justice.
Right.
And so therefore what they did was they said the only way to achieve exact justice is through monetary valuation. And that's actually what the Torah means. People often misunderstand that. It's not that the sages said, oh, whoa, we don't want to do that. Let's soften this and just we'll work with the monetary. It's not what they said. They said is that it can't be that what the Torah means is to actually put out one another's eyes because that wouldn't be justice because there's too many variable factors between my eye and your eye. So it must be that when it said eye for an eye, it meant you must do exact justice. And our job is to do exact justice for God in the world, and that can only happen through monetary valuation.
Love it. That's fabulous. Great explanation.
Which is part of the reason that Gandhi, who had no inkling of Jewish culture, misunderstood what was happening here.
Yeah. But you know, like, you know, it irks me. It always irks me. And I sent you an email.
I did see it.
I sent you an email with some of Gandhi's wacky phrases.
Right. Whatever, I don't want to go back into that
right now.
Let's
not go to Gandhi. God bless him. But there were some unpleasant phrases there. But in any case, okay, I didn't like that. And I just want to also throw in the opposite. My father, love of Shalom, I said this every year. I think I said it this year at the cemetery. He said that what this means is the difference between the sages and this eye for an eye. He said, if the courts of law don't take care of business, then I will. Meaning to say, my court of law will.
Mm-hmm.
And that we learned that in Pirkei Avot. Remember when Hillel sees somebody was drowned, he said, well, you drowned somebody, so they drowned you.
What goes around comes around.
Meaning to say that the sages say, okay, we have a way to deal with it in this world, which we will figure out the monetary value, which is more exacting, whatever. But God says, but if you don't do that, I will take it up. I'll take up the case.
I would add to that as well is that it is kind of an instinctive human experience to want to retribution.
Right.
And so therefore, if the courts don't serve exact justice, they're not just leaving things in the hands of God. They're unleashing the sort of like the human instinct for retribution.
Right.
And this is a big challenge I see in our country right now is the failure I perceive to be the failure of our government to enforce law and order between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River has opened a door for people who are driven by what is a very natural, if not positive, desire for vengeance and retribution.
Right. Vigilantism is oftentimes not people who are against the law or don't care about the law. Vigilantism is when the law...
Has
failed people. I want to give you just one example. There's been a big discussion right now about money that's coming from Qatar, supposed to go through Israel to go to Hamas, Gaza.
Yeah, we call it protection money.
Okay. But they want to pay, the Qataris are trying to pay the Hamasnikim, the Hamas,
to be quiet.
But the point is, they have a problem with transferring money. They wanted to transfer it through Israel.
Right.
So I had a simple question. I'm like, Netanyahu, you got $15 million like in paper bags.
Mamish.
Right.
In
are
cash.
Are there no...
In $100 bills.
Like, shouldn't you have turned around and been like, thank you very much. And before I pay that to Hamas, I just want to make sure that I don't have any open court, legal decisions against Hamas's hundreds and thousands of murders for, you know, and the various acts of horrific crime that they aren't there. There's way more than
$15 million
in compensation.
Bucket. Dropping,
it's nothing.
Dropping a
bucket. But you know what? Take 15 people, give them $1 million. Okay.
Yeah, but you and I both know why that money is flowing.
You know, I'm just trying to make a point, which is you're it just angered me. I'm just like, there are people that have judgments against Hamas. And you have their money now,
right?
So then freeze their account, kavyachol,
right?
And just here you go, take this paper bag.
By the way, that's why it's happening in paper bags through, because you can't pass it through the banks, because there are so many legal and political ways in which that money will be frozen. Because that money, like I said, it has nothing to do with justice; it has to do with politics. It's protection money, and it's part of the ongoing attempt to see, like, keep welding the lid on a boiling over situation in the hopes that it'll go away. You know, I'm really not sure what it is.
You know, when I talk about these things, it makes me boil inside, especially because I was there and was kicked out by the chief of police out of a house in Gush Katif, and we all saw it go down. We saw this thing become.
Oh yeah,
and it's such a horrible thing. Okay, you have a. We're now still chapter 21. Let's say around verses 29. You have a. You have a piece of property. It's a living piece of property that is a bull. Now, bulls are work animals, you know, or those longhorns and all those things are work animals, but they need to be kept properly, and maybe there might be a situation where a bull. Is that the right word, bull? Is that the right?
It's an ox.
Ox. Okay, sorry. Okay. What's the difference? Oh, one's a cow and
let's not go there. Just translate it as an ox.
Okay, fine. So an ox. I'm not exactly a field worker. I haven't put a yoke on an ox in a long time. Try to put a yoke on myself. So this ox gores to death a man or a woman.
Oxicide. Sorry.
It's not funny. Yeah. Okay. So this ox has to be put to death.
Sin.
He has to be put to death, and you're not allowed to eat his flesh. That's another interesting thing.
What's called an Isser Hana'a.
Right.
Right. It's that once anything, in fact, not anything, but many things that have been used to take the life of a human being, right, they become beyond the pale. Like the sword which is used, even in the execution in court, is buried. Right? No longer, you shouldn't be able to look at that sword and say, that's the sword that killed so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, this ox needs to go.
Mm-hmm.
And there should be no benefit taken from it.
Okay, if this is a mu'ad, meaning to say it's already shown itself to do this already three times,
mm-hmm.
is a killer. That's a totally different thing. Now you're now you
note have, to self: watch the ox.
Right, watch the ox. Tie him down. Oh no! I just killed my next door neighbor. Oh, I didn't mean that. Wasn't me.
It's a gory story.
Right, it's a gory story. But what happened here is again this is a furtherance of your responsibility.
These are, by the way, another fundamental, and this is to me what's most interesting aside from, like you said, we could spend forever going into the details, but it's critical to understand that the Torah's perspective on property, as with all other areas of law, is one of obligation and not rights. I mean, most of the discourse in tort law is in America or in Western law is about property rights. It's a whole segment of tort law. Right? There's no such thing as property rights in the Torah. It's property obligations.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you own something, now the Torah begins to articulate, okay, well, what kind of responsibilities come with owning an ox?
Right.
Never tells you what kind of rights come with it.
Right.
And that's an important shift in perspective in terms of this sort of larger existence you were articulating before, like I have a car and it's bigger me and et cetera. So here, like, you should understand that more property means more responsibility.
Right. But what about if I do an act that ostensibly is a neutral act, I dig a hole? I dug a hole. Okay, I dug a pit.
We call it a ditch.
A ditch. I dug a ditch. I dug something somewhere, but it was in the public space,
mm-hmm.
and my camel or my donkey.
Somebody else's camel or donkey.
Right. Oh, right. I dug it. Or somebody else's camel or donkey steps in it and breaks his...
goes headlong into the ditch. Breaks right. his four legs.
Or breaks even one leg and becomes in a... What?
I meant four legs, like his front legs.
What? Forget it. Four legs. Okay.
You're like, wow, that's a bad fall. How do you do that with a camel? It's a big ditch. All right. Let's move on.
That's right. Okay. Are you culpable of that? Was it a ditch that was in the public space? Was it big enough that it was going to hurt an animal? Or did this animal have a freakish
accident? Weak legs, right.
Right. It was like it stepped into a little, you made a tiny little, you were...
Divot.
Right. And then suddenly this thing falls, breaks his head on a rock or something. So something unusual. Okay. So what is your responsibility?
And this is the part of our parsha that introduces what are known as the Arba Avot Nezikin, right? These four fundamental categories of damages, and all of them are about responsibility, right? The shorbor, right? Gosh,
fire.
Shorbor ish. I'm like so embarrassing. All right, I'll let it go. I'll just like Chatai name is going to go home.
That's good. That's good.
On the first parak in Baba Kama. I mean, it's like the beginning of Nezikin.
Okay, my
point was is that these are the fundamental categories of damages that dictate your responsibility beyond your person into your property in the world. This is the way you're meant to walk in the world. You dig a ditch. I don't care if you dig it in the public space and you walk away and say, I'm done with that.
I didn't actually do anything. I
created a problematic situation, right. And there is no such thing.
Right.
As walking away from a situation that you've created in the Torah. That's the whole idea. You create that situation, there is no such thing as walking away. You either fix it or you own it.
Right. Public nuisance is what I wrote for myself.
I've been called that before.
It's a public enemy, actually.
So, no, not that. That's your job.
Yeah, that's right. That's Run DMC.
I'm just a nuisance.
Right.
I haven't gotten to enemy status yet.
So, yeah, I'm definitely public enemy. I revel in it.
I know now that speaking I'm following you on Twitter, I see that.
Yeah, that's right. I make trouble out there.
Yeah, and you enjoy it. I can see the smile coming through the words.
That's right. And also, yeah, and we had this big thing, TIFF.
Yeah, a little TIFF.
We had a TIFF. We have the Temporary International Presence in Hebron.
Which has now been proven to be temporary.
That's
as
right.
Opposed to the last
everybody keeps using the words.
5 years.
They've been evicted. They've been ousted. Expelled. I'm like, no, their term ran out.
Yeah,
their term
after
ran
25
right.
years.
Their term ran out. It's over. Nothing happened. Nobody's expelling them.
Right, it's not like they went in and tossed them.
You did your thing.
Right.
Did you do it well? I'm not saying you did it well, but you did your thing, and now you're done. And sayonara.
Right. Hence the temporary part of
that's
the
right.
Name.
I know. By the way, I got a message from on high that Netanyahu is facing tremendous pressure right now from Europeans to rescind the
to make permanent the temporary.
Right. There you go. Okay, I guess we have to speed up a little bit, but the other thing that the other similar thing to the ox that gores to the pit that you made is to fire. Okay, fire is this thing. I'm into fire. I like fire a lot. I like to teach my kids the rules of fire. Fire and water are things that you have to teach how to deal with them. There are things that you need to, just like driving, but like if you're gonna make a fire, you better give them the real rules. You're an outdoorsman. How to really handle the whole fire thing? Where don't be too afraid of it.
Right.
Don't be too afraid of it. You could step on it. You could push it with a stick. If you're wearing a glove, you can move the thing. You know, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand,
don't play with it.
Right. Don't play with it, and certainly prepare for it to.
It has a little bit of a will of its own.
Exactly. That's the beauty of fire.
That's why it's its own category of damages. Mm-hmm. Right? Because there's either a higher level of responsibility or the opportunity to divest oneself of responsibility and say, well, listen, the fire went that way. I didn't send it.
We also have the categories of theft and how theft is found and theft is caught in different situations. And similar to that, very interesting, is the whole category, the categories of...
Shomrim.
Shomrim.
Guards, people that are responsible for...
Right. You're going on vacation. You say to your neighbor...
Hey, watch my house.
Can you watch my house? Can you watch my Fabergé egg? You know? Okay. And the Fabergé egg breaks.
Lo and behold,
it's
not there when you get
home. So what are the responsibilities? How much responsibility? That's also the same thing. Rental and leasing, borrowing.
Borrowing
is a big problem, right? Borrowing is a big problem. My brother, for example, God bless him, my brother's a great videographer, Josh Fleischer. He doesn't like to lend out books. When I ask him for a book, he says, okay, it's yours now. Because I don't want to.
Because it creates a real obligation. When I was in college, we were all very into the outdoors and climbing in particular. Climbing gear could be very sensitive.
Right.
But we had what we called the universal gear principle, which is that it's returned in the same state as you borrowed it or new.
Right.
Right. And that sounds great until you borrow someone's car. Right? It's a hard thing.
Sometimes somebody asks you for your car, like, no.
Yeah, I generally say no.
Right.
Which is hard because you want to be generous and you want to be helpful, but it's you know, aside from my house, the most expensive thing I own.
Right.
And actually much more likely to get wrecked.
Yeah, it's a dangerous object. Okay, what about if you are, God forbid, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Don't know.
You have a virgin girl, but you, what's the word? Seduction, right? So what's wrong? You don't like the seduction aspect?
I'm just wondering where you're going with this. You seem to be picking every tough law in the book.
It's not a word that I use a lot. You know what I mean? It's not like Judean Samaria and Hebron is so seductive. Okay, so
but you're working on it.
I'm working to make it more alluring. Okay, alluring. Okay, so
just remember you're being recorded.
Okay, no, I know. It's my show. I can do it.
This is Juan. Just remember.
Ishai, note to self, edit this part out. Just joking. If somebody seduces a man seduces a woman, okay, to have relations, to have sexual intercourse. However, that that devalues this girl or puts her now as no longer a virgin. So now
in the marital market, as it were.
In the marital market, as it were. Okay, so what happens? You're supposed to pay the mohar. What's the word?
Bride price.
Bride price. There's another word, isn't there?
No, it's not dowry.
It's not dowry?
Because dowry is what a woman takes into marriage. The bride price is what a man gives in order to marry a woman.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different societal sort of like value being expressed. So here it's specifically, you know, in the Torah's conception, a virgin bride can demand a higher bride price.
When can I keep demanding for my father-in-law more stuff? I want him to buy me a new gun. He's a Texan, and I want to be like, look, this is your part in the battle.
I would just go with the Texan thing and not start trying to demand a bride price.
Right, I'm not going to quote him
at this stage of marriage.
Okay, very good. A witch? Kill her. Kill her. Don't let witches and
how do you know she's a witch?
How do you know she's a witch?
She floats. That's the same movie. All right, that's number two. Anybody can get that. If they didn't get the first reference, you get the second. It's Ralph Mike at the Land of Israel.
I obviously did not see this movie. Okay, I'm not a witch. I'm your wife. Which movie is that from? Everybody knows that one. I'm not a witch. I'm your wife. That's like
you lost me on that one.
Oh my god, man! Everybody knows that one.
All right, when we're done, I'll
like
tell you standard. Mine if you tell me yours.
No, we'll wait till next week. That's standard fare. Everybody, and if somebody can get both,
then you'll make
Yishai
smile.
I will send you a book. I will send you Rabbi Mike's latest book.
Really, you will?
Yes, I will.
Ooh.
If you could get both of those, #, I know both of them,
and I benefit.
That's right. There you go.
There you go.
Right.
Okay, if you don't know mine, you can be in touch with me.
What?
Nothing.
Okay. I didn't hear that. Okay, sleeping with animals. Not good.
Like I said, you're just going for every rough law here.
I'm sorry.
You're just going down the list.
It's black and parchment here. Okay? Do not have intercourse with animals. Why not? What's the biggie? You're both consenting mammals. No? What's the big deal?
You can't expect me to hear the phrase, you're both consenting mammals, and just let that fly. In a nutshell, let's remember that the Torah's perspective on sexuality has two sides to it. One is procreative.
Mm-hmm.
It's a general attitude that the purpose of relationship is the sort of propagation and extension of creation, which isn't going to happen with a sheep. Right? And the other one is sort of emotional, psychological, spiritual intimacy, which is also not really going to happen there. So
okay,
right?
But you get put to death, and the animal also gets put to death.
Yes, because it is a distraction from the plan, so to speak.
Right.
Remember, and this again goes back to the difference between the individual and the societal. We live in a society where I'm okay, you're okay. Listen. What happens, you know, like you don't want government in your bedroom is a classic, you know, American law stance, which I have a lot of empathy for. At the same time, that is just not the stance the Torah takes. Mm-hmm. I mean, like whatever one wants to think about it is not the stance the Torah takes.
I think it goes back to what we said earlier, which is it cuts it cuts. What you used a great phrase before. Like it somehow is destructive for society.
Yes,
it's destructive for humanity. Because
anything which undermines, excuse me, I hate to sound too conservative, but anything which undermines the family unit undermines society.
Right, but yeah, I think also that we get caught up, and I think your students may get caught up on the death side, but I think the warning side is also very important. Like a lot of times, people don't understand the seriousness of Shabbat, for example.
Yes.
Just the warning and the fear and the seriousness makes these borders very, very solid.
Right, which is why the sages felt free in many cases to legislate these punishments all but out of existence, like you pointed out, right? By placing so many parameters on what it actually takes to condemn someone to death. But at the same time, then, why did the Torah say death? Precisely for what you said, it's because this is an expression of absolute value. It's a non-negotiable. The fact that we're going to be merciful and we don't want a society of sort of constant judicial blood spilling is also a value that the sages saw in the Torah. They didn't pull it out of thin air.
Right.
Right? But it doesn't undermine the fact that these are absolute boundaries to the Torah's conception of society.
Interesting that God comes back in a very loud way suddenly when it talks about the foreigner or the widow or the orphan that are somehow squeezed in society, and suddenly God says, if this group will cry out, I will hear that cry. Mm-hmm. I will hear. This is a very liberal moment in the Torah. God says, in this case, if I have to align politically, in this case, I'm very liberal.
Tell the people where you are.
Right? I'm talking about 22:22. Easy enough to remember, 22. It says, imanota neoto. If you what's the word I'm looking for here?
If you oppress.
If you oppress him, ki im tzaok itzak elai, if he shall cry out to me, shamo shma tzakato, I will certainly hear his cry out. God like sticks himself into this legal tract mm-hmm. that we're dealing with. He says, I hear this. And then, v'chara pi, I'm going to be angry. V'aragti tchem, I'm going to kill you. B'cherev, on the sword. V'yu neshetechem, v'yu neshechem almanot, your wives will be widows. And your sons will be orphans. Meaning to say, I'm serious here, God says, like protect the weak classes.
And I want to throw something out there, which is potentially a challenge for people listening, is that the word ger in the Torah is often translated in people's minds as convert. But here we have a great indicator that is not possible, that the word ger means sojourner. And Rashi actually explicitly says, kol lashon ger, anywhere where it says ger, Adam shelo nolad ba'otah medina. It's simply someone who wasn't born in that country. El ababa medina acheret lagur sham. But he came from another place to live there. And I'm not going to weigh in on the whole immigrant question of what's going on in the world today. But it needs to be taken to heart that the Torah assumes that the primary obligation of society toward those who aren't from around here is not to kick them out, but to take care of them because they are disadvantaged and exposed. Right? I mean, in the same way as the clear statements that we had earlier, this is about as clear as it gets.
There's a proof that the Torah is actually written for Jews. It's verse 23:6. Lo tateh mishpat evyoncha beribo. Do not lean your judgment towards the poor person in his poverty. Right?
Right.
That line can only be.
We'd say in Yeshiva, what was the Havamina?
Right. Well, yeah. Right. The Havamina, right, is that what was the thinking here? I know Jews. I know you guys. You guys have a liberal. You have a liberal heart.
And caring heart.
A caring heart. Right. Liberal, I just know. I'm actually putting it on purpose.
Not all conservatives are cold hearted.
Right. No. I know, but I'm putting it to show that there are these conservative swings and these liberal swings actually.
But I take exception at that because I think that it's not that conservatives are uncaring or that liberals are always caring. They have different ideologies and there's different ways to weigh out those measures. By the way, being caring to immigrants doesn't necessarily mean, giving whatever they want and allowing people just to cross your borders without law, etc. Because what happens when you overwhelm the society and the entire social fabric collapses?
Right.
So then you can't help anybody.
That's right.
So I just think we're going to be careful in the association.
But I am being careful by showing that. That's my point. I'm trying to show, look, here's this and here's this. And this mode swings because those polarized modes are actually not correct.
Yeah.
It's just not correct. It's not a correct way of looking at things. And here, this moment, you have to have a quote-unquote liberal heart. Here, you have to be quote unquote, have a conservative heart about these things.
My point is you can have, you here you have to have a caring heart, and here you have to stand firm.
Yes.
With the law.
Okay. We're in good shape. I think the audience understands us in this case. And then suddenly there's going to be also a group of laws about the land of Israel, and that, and it will tell us a few things about the land of Israel. First thing is that 6 years you shall, this is already verse 10 of chapter 23, 6 years you plant the land and gather, but on the seventh year you're going to leave it fallow, and the poor are going to eat, and the animal of the field is going to eat, and there's going to be a kind of, I call it the shake-up of the Etch-a-Sketch. You know, it's going to, it's a little bit of time.
Reset.
A reset button. There's an importance for the Sabbath, and there's another kind of yearly cycle. There's the Sabbath, there's the seventh year cycle, and then there's also the three times a year that you have to come up to me. And now for the first time, we're going to be told about the three big ones, the three
festivals,
the three
right.
festival holidays, which are you're going to come up by your feet. That's why they're called regalim. And techog means also encircle. Okay, you're going to go around. And these are the three festival holidays, the three pilgrimage holidays to Jerusalem. They are, of course, Passover,
Shavuot.
Weeks, Shavuot, right? And Sukkot, what people call booths. Okay?
Make your tickets now, people. It's not too late for the coming regal.
That's right. That's right. All right. Listen, we got to take a break here for a second. We not taking a break. We have five more minutes here because you've got a student meeting, and that's great. That was until the sixth aliyah. This was this kind of legal tract, codex with an X at the end. I guess there's a codex on our codec here. Whatever. That was wonky.
Just roll with it.
Wonky
roll with
joke.
It.
Okay.
We've made it several.
By the way, I'm really happy for geeks in general.
Yeah.
Because there's new terminology like the geek squad or to geek. I really geek out on something.
Yeah.
And it's like cool to be. It's like the revenge
of
the nerds.
It's been since the revenge of the nerds.
Yeah.
Exactly what I was saying.
Nerds.
And my daughter said to me the other day, like, "Gosh, Abba, you're such a geek." And I said, "Who cares?" And she's, "What do you mean who cares?" She's, you know, 13.
Right.
I said, I'm married with children. I've won already.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. No, but also geeks are like cool today, you know.
Yeah.
Geeks,
well, they run the world.
You know, my son says to me, my son, he's eight.
Who's a bigger geek than Bill Gates?
Right.
He runs
right. Geeks
the world.
Run the world. That's right. My son says to me, "I want to learn how to hack." I'm like, he goes, "Can you buy me a little computer to hack?" I'm like, "Yes, yes, I will." Okay, okay. But the last bit actually goes to a different kind of narrative. And God says, "I'm going to bring you to the land. I'm going to send my angel in front of you. And it's going to be a tough situation because the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Jebusites are going to be there.
Scary.
Do not bow down to them. You're going to have to fight with them. Do not bow down to them. Destroy their high places."
You love that line.
Well, it's not that I love it. It also is a proof to
you
me.
You love
that
it. You read it the same way every time.
You know why? Because it's important to do that. Because it's important to understand. You know, God says, here's my liberal take. God says, I said this in a big speech one time outside of the Lion's Gate. God says, be liberal with me. Give me my little room in this world. I don't ask you to clean out the world like Islam to convert the world. Just give me my tiny little space to be without crosses and without half crescent moons and without any idolatry. Give me my space. That's what I want. I'm not asking you to take over the world. Give me my tiny little Jerusalem, and you'll see the whole world will change just based on that. All right?
Apparently it's too much.
It's too much. That's right. I'm going to I'm going to bless you. Your land is not going to have, what's it called? Childless women.
Barren.
There's nothing barren. My words are not strong today. Okay, that's okay. I will send my fear in front of you. I will send some kind of like plague to get the bad guys before you. I'm not going to get rid of them immediately. I'm going to get rid of them piecemeal, slowly but surely, because, and here's the word, it's verse 23, chapter 23, verse 30. Matmata gershenami panecha. Slowly, slowly will I kick them out from before you. Why is that, in my opinion? Process. It's going to look like the natural flow of things. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to be there with you. But it's not going to be like miracles like leaving the Exodus of Egypt. It's a different game. It's going to look like the natural game, okay? But don't let them stick in this land. Do not cut deals with them, because they're going to sit in your land and they're going to make you sin to follow their gods. And they're going to be a blockage before you, right?
Yep.
Okay, and then God is going to kind of reveal himself. The 70 elders are going to see some kind of very high image of God. They're going to see the sapphire brickwork.
It's a very dramatic ending to this sort of second round of revelation.
Right. And it's interesting. See, in Judaism, it's like I always ask Jewish, I ask little kids, I say to them, I tell you that the Esav's head is buried here in Marat HaMachpelah. Is that a good thing for Esav or a bad thing? Like, you might think that somebody gets their head cut off and just their head is buried here. It's a bad thing.
Bad news.
And right. Jewish kids are always like, it's a good thing. Jewish kids always get it. Yeah. I'm like, that's right.
Because he made it into Marat HaMachpelah.
Because his head made it into Marat HaMachpelah. That's right. And kids get that. Like, it's weird.
Listen, everybody's got to die. You're going to be buried somewhere.
Right. But they get that. They get that. Even though your head and your body are you know, you're decapitated, it's cool that you got into Marat HaMachpelah. Kids get that. That's so weird. I test them every time.
Kids understand decapitation.
Yeah. They, anyway, however, here, there are some understandings by the sages that it wasn't such a good thing. That they saw so much.
Mm-hmm.
That they saw so much that they kind of were a little bit too merry at seeing this.
There was a certain inappropriate mix of the sort of physical and spiritual, if you will, here.
Yes.
Yeah. It's tough. It's a tough balance to strike because we as a people are always trying to actually
see God.
Not just see God, but to deny that there really is a distinction between the spiritual and the physical. Mm-hmm. We don't really accept that Western dualism. But at the same time, it's deeply seated in our experience of the world. And there is a utility of a demanding that you rise above your sort of more base physical self. But rise above and to sanctify are two very different things.
So let's read that verse, 24:10. They saw vayir'u et Elohei Israel. They saw the God of Israel, v'tachat raglav, and underneath his legs. Blank, right? Question mark. Kemaaseh livnat haSapir, like sapphire brickwork, u'ke'etzem haShemayim laTorah, and to the heart of the heavens in purity.
Right.
I mean, this verse says to you, it's like one of these verses that's like, warning, you will not get me. I'm saying something that you will not get.
Don't,
you can try to understand me, but I'm saying that you don't know, right? Like what you saw. And so, you know, Rashi says that this was a great moment, but there are other places where they actually got zapped later on for seeing this or for kind of, right. The next verse actually says that God did not, to the nobles of Israel, the noble people of Israel, he didn't zap them.
Implying.
That there was a little bit of a place to zap them, right? And they ate and they drank. Something, it's as you said, it's a tough moment.
By the way, notice how this really, which is kind of the end of the parsha here, more or less, it is a parallel, a bookend, if you will, to the way we began, which is that lest you think that this codex has simply been tort law like you'll find in Rome or America or, I don't know, China or where else, right? That it begins and ends in Revelation. Right? And that's not simply an authoritarian statement, which is, well, now you have to keep the law because God said so. It's also a statement of aspiration that the purpose of the law is not simply to make an orderly society that allows people to get along, which it also is. The purpose of the law is to make a vessel for God's presence on earth. Right? God says, here I am at Sinai. See me. Here I am at the end of this parsha of Revelation. See me. Now know that the law that I've given you in between is the only vessel you have to bring that presence back to earth.
And yet, Rabbi Mike, there's a tension between what you're saying, which is so beautiful, and so you want to accept that with a tension that even exists at the very last verse, second to last verse, in this Torah portion, which is 24:17, it says, and the umar'ek vod Hashem, and the sight of the honor of God, or the vision of the honor of Hashem, is like an eating fire, ke'esh ochelet b'roshaha, is like a consuming fire at the apex of the mountain. Leinei Bnei Israel, to the eyes of the children of Israel. There is something in that approach towards the Godhead. Okay,
yeah.
There's a singeing element there. We're playing
with fire.
You're playing with fire. You're not playing. Right. I didn't want to use that word suddenly because it's not really a game. It's not a play. It's life. It's real. But you Jewish people, you're going to have a great role in this world. You're going to bring the law into this world. You're going to be a chosen nation, et cetera, et cetera. But just understand, there's also like revelation is
the power of what is being given here has a chance to transform or destroy.
Yes, I like that. Thank you very much. That's an excellent way to finish it. Okay, Moses goes up, and he's out there receiving the Torah 40 days and 40 nights. God calls to him from the seventh day. By the way, my take on this is, it's the verse says that he went up to the Mount Sinai. He was up there 6 days, and on the seventh day, God spoke to him. So he's searching for God for 7 days, for 6 days. God. God's like, sorry, talk to the proverbial hand, to the anthropomorphized hand. It comes back to when Moses, when God was like, Moses.
For seven days.
He says, okay.
Two can play at this game.
Right. I tried to tell you, go down to Egypt and save the Jewish people, and I had to argue with you for 7 days.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're not going to find me so easily as well. And I love that the Torah shows this kind of tension between even God's most beloved and this very hard thing, like birth. It's very hard to bring a new life into this world. It's very hard to meet God in this world. Rabbi Mike Foyer has a fabulous show here on our network called The Jewish Story. That's what it's called, and it's found here on the Land of Israel Network. You could also find him at Facebook, facebook.com/Rav Mike. You can email him, ravmike@thelandofisrael.com, or did I say jewishstory.co?
You did not.
I did not. Jewishstory.co. There you go. And that's fabulous. And also check out Rav Mike's new book, co-authored with the Rabbi Dave Mason, which is called The Key of Rain. Okay, and it's actually... It's up to bat right now on my sleeping bookshelf. There's a sleeping bookshelf.
I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, I'm very excited. Malka loves it very much, so that's really exciting. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today and going a little overtime. I know you have a student waiting for you. We're overtime, okay? So Shabbat Shalom. Thank you so much. Lots of good energy to the world. And I think I want to call the show maybe like Love the Law.
Love the law.
That
sounds good to me.
Just love the law. Embrace the law. Don't listen to those voices that have said in the past that the law is somehow to keep you away from God.
Stands between you and God. Yeah.
It's such a mistaken. It's like I can understand. By the way, we say that in the Hasidic world also says don't be overly. You know,
you don't worship the law. You're looking to worship God.
Right.
But this is the great gift that God has given us to connect heaven and earth.
Absolutely. Okay, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show. Of course, with the help of God, Malka Fleischer's on next. So stay tuned for that. Rabbi Mike, thanks again.
Always a pleasure.
Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. We'll be right back with more. And Shalom.
The Little Spacecraft is a book being launched today in Israel, literally launched by Dr. Mom as part of her company, Stellar Nova. In just a few weeks, Israel is sending a spacecraft to the moon, and her book is going to be on board.
It's still amazingly exciting to think that you're drawing a picture that's going to go to the moon, to think about what else we can learn, and this whole world that there's so much left to explore.
Listen in to my show, Rejuvenation, with Eve Harrow, as I interview a brilliant chemist and mom who is trying to excite the kids towards science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. If you get excited about it when you're young, it's a passion that will never leave. Listen in to Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network.
And we're back here on the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Judea to the world. Judea to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. And Shalom and welcome to Malka.
Hello, Yishai.
Thank you so much.
Is this going to be the weirdest show ever?
It's been a very long day, okay? I was up and doing stuff, just meeting after meeting to recording to meeting to things, and
well,
I just came
first,
back.
You have to go
I just
backwards.
Came back from Moga.
You came back from where?
Moga.
I thought you said Boca. I
no,
was
not,
like,
not
you
Boca.
Were gone for an extremely short time.
Yes, and I bought
I made you,
something. You
breakfast this morning. And no, now we're recording in the nighttime.
I came back from Moga. I'm a big believer in men's yoga.
Moga?
I heard that today in Gush Etzion.
Is that like MAGA?
I think it's make yoga great again. That's what it is. And it's just yoga. And anyway, men's yoga. I just love, I think that yoga is so smart. I wish I could do it more in my life, but I do it once a week
is not bad.
It's
I mean
fab.
Maybe you should do some of your moves like every once in a while.
Yes.
In the living room.
It is a brilliant. It's the Talmud of exercise. Mm. That's what I call it. Just like Guinness is the Trellant of beers.
Mm, so good.
Yeah. Guinness. But, of course, from a draft and not from one of those.
From the can, which is too bad, really.
Yeah, I wish that would work. But it is Shabbos coming up, and I would like to ask for some Hoegaarden.
Oh, yeah?
But
I already went to the grocery store this
week. Don't worry about it, then. Next week. Okay.
But I'll try to get it next week.
It is a good week for a Hoegaarden so far in that Tiff. The temporary international presence in Hebron has its mandate has run out. I say
well,
it this
what
way.
Is that? Wait, go backwards a little bit because I'm not sure that everybody understands what TIFF is or why we're even talking about this at all.
You know, Hebron, where I work, is a place that has seen conflict, including the famous shooting of Muslim worshippers in 1994 by Dr. Baruch Goldstein, a very lamentable incident. And of course, there's been thousands and thousands of terror attacks against the Jewish community there, including ones that I have seen myself many a time already.
Terrible things.
Parentheses, I want to say something too.
Well, parentheses, go.
Our neighborhood, which I miss very much in the Mount of Olives, mm-hmm. has been victim of successive firebombing in the last few weeks, mm-hmm. and I have not seen that anywhere in the news, and I want to put that onto your like radar screen.
What do you mean?
In terms of your news writing.
In terms of my news writing, yeah. The firebombs in Maale Zeitim, the Jewish community on the Mount of Olives, is not news to me. We lived with it when we were living there. There are different houses that are more susceptible to firebombs within the neighborhood than others, and we knew the neighbors who would suffer under very frightening firebomb attacks. And, you know, the Jerusalem police are like right there. It's right next to the old city of Jerusalem, one of the most protected and secured places probably on planet Earth.
Yeah.
And like they couldn't manage to.
And currently are not managing. Not in
right.
The past.
And to me, the only answer is that they choose not to. They choose not to enforce the law there.
I just feel like
there.
You should get it out there in your news writing.
It was always a question mark over there in Maale Zeitim. There was a disparity of opinion between people. Some people said, we have to take this to the news. We have to take this to the news because only by taking things to the news will things become exposed, and then politicians feel embarrassed, and then they apply pressure back on the police. But there were other people who said, don't publicize these events because everyone should feel that life on the Mount of Olives is completely normal, come and go, Jewish community, absolutely, absolutely fine. Why should anyone think that somebody's living in a war zone right here in the capital of Israel?
I would add to that, it's not because they wanted to put on rose-colored glasses. It's because they wanted people to come and actually come to the tombs,
right.
The tombs of the famous people, and they created a bus line.
And why not, right?
Right.
Where in any country should there be a city where police go, you know what? We're just not going to enforce law over here.
Right, there's no-go zones. There's
Why should we have zones like that? That's right. Really disgusting. Right. And especially in the capital of the country, and not just any capital, it's Jerusalem. It's like a beacon of light for the world.
So the PLO today, under the guise of the PA, the PLO put out another... there's a lot of these fancy documents that are coming out. We'll talk about it in a second. So they just put out a document today that I saw on Twitter, you know, Sheikh Jarrah under the Israeli occupying power, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wrote back, you know, because it's Twitter.
What, on Twitter, you mean?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I just wrote back right now. I just wrote back, better our occupation than your occupation.
For real.
You know?
If somebody has to occupy, if somebody's going to be called an occupier, believe me, you want it to be us.
But I mean, and who are you? You are really an occupier, and you're really a foreigner, and your whole PA is an occupier. Your whole thing isn't your occupation. So I thought to myself, that was what I wrote. Better our occupation than your occupation.
Wait, so take that train back to TIFF.
Okay,
the temporary international presence in Hebron.
Right, so these guys.
When did they show up?
They showed up 21 years ago.
Why? Who are they?
They showed up. They are a conglomeration of four European countries and Turkey. I think it's Turkey, Norway, Italy, and whatever. And so these countries conglomerated under an agreement that actually was between Israel and the PA,
mm-hmm.
to monitor. And this is so irksome, to monitor the. Basically, to protect Arabs from the Jews, to protect Arabs of Hebron from the Jews of Hebron. Okay? Okay. And then from time to time, they would put on a guise as though they were just peace monitoring and making sure.
And they walk around being extremely blonde, wearing these vests.
They're not all blonde because a lot of them are Turks and stuff like that. They walk around with these vests and they take photographs. And my contention, this is what I've said in the news media, is that when you do that, you actually create an atmosphere of conflict. And you're not making an atmosphere of peace because there's this feeling that these guys give you that, like, you're not welcome here. You're not right to be here any minute now.
Who is not welcome?
When the Tiffers, when the internationals walk around with their cameras, with their vests, they give off a feeling like you're a monkey in a zoo. And that also,
and they're watching you all
and
the
they're
time.
Watching you. And also that there should be conflict because you're all conflict ridden people. So any minute now, conflict is going to break out. They just give that feeling. Mm-hmm. And without them, and I'm excited to see them. And I want to say a lot of people have been very nervous. Oh, sorry. I'm jumping ahead. They've been here for 21 years. And there's been a lot of pressure put on Prime Minister Netanyahu not to renew their mandate, to make it clear.
What is this mandate?
The mandate is to walk around Hebron.
And they have to be allowed, basically, to walk around the city?
It's an agreement. It's not a foreign force. Uh-huh. It's an agreed-to force. Okay, it's an agreed to force that Israel agreed to, and every
year they have to be renewed,
even half a year. And wow. And then I heard it that it was even shorter span than that. But every short amount of time. So for 21 years, the state of Israel has signed off on this monitoring force.
That is so dumb,
right?
Why would we do this to ourselves?
Well, because they wanted to make nice to the international, saying we'll make sure that the Jews of Hebron don't
yell at people.
They act properly in some way. In any case, it was a kind of a gift to the international community, saying like, okay, we'll put in these monitors in place. Mm-hmm. The monitors were really there to spy, to make sure that the Jews don't grow too much, or that they don't, and to give that atmosphere of conflict, like I was saying to you. And also because Turkey is a kind of a country that's at a state of war with us to some extent. Right. I don't want to overstate that case because we do fly through Turkey.
My understanding is they would get in the way of IDF soldiers in their work also.
Mostly, the real stuff that started going down is that they were caught slapping a kid on video.
Oh, they were caught slapping a Jewish child.
Kid. Yeah. And then they were also caught puncturing tires, Jewish tires.
Doesn't seem professional.
And just the atmosphere that they were giving off was this really negative atmosphere, okay? So pressure was put by various groups, ministers, Knesset members, Yisrael Sheli, the Yesha Council, Eugene Kantorovich from Kohelet Policy Forum, etc. Lots of folks were on this thing. They were pushing, which is a relatively simple ask, which is stop renewing their mandate. Well, it's also an election cycle and all that. And Prime Minister Netanyahu finally did not renew their mandate.
Which is awesome.
Which is also on another level, like also not such a big deal because it's a simple thing. But anyway, he didn't renew the mandate. All the newspapers are like Netanyahu expelling foreign observers, expulsion. He's booting them out. Observer force booted out. And it's like, no, nobody's being booted. Nobody's being booted at all. And it's just your work here is done. Thank you.
Thanks for all that.
I'm not going to say you did a good job. I'm just saying bye and thanks a lot. And so and they're gone. And there was a lot of speculation that TIFF would, there was a lot of
Well, they're gone. Are they gone? Gone? Oh. Like, is it officially done? So, because I understand that there are powers who are applying pressure, European ministers and things who are applying,
so
trying to apply pressure on Netanyahu to keep the TIFFers.
Let me let you in on some information.
Ooh, is this?
Yes,
censored information.
No, it's
can we all know about this?
It's for print. I already sent it to Variuses. And the regional battalion commander of the Judean
battalion, People's Front.
That's right. Of the Judean
Battalion. The People's
battalion.
Front of Judea.
By the way, if you've ever seen the Judean tag, it's like the tomb of Maharat Machpelah is at the center of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That is cool.
Yeah.
I want to see that.
So I'm just telling you about
the battalion commander.
Yes.
Of the IDF Judean Army.
That's right.
Yes, says.
The Judean Army. Battalion commander says that he's been given orders They are not allowed to operate anymore as of the 1st of February.
Who they TIFF.
The TIFF. And he is sitting down with them to make sure that they close up all
which
operations.
Which is in 2 days.
And he's and they're just basically packing up now. And the army has been told to make sure that they're not walking around. It's over.
How do you anticipate this really affecting Hebron?
No way. It's gonna be a nicer day. That's all. There's just gonna be not these annoying tiffers. That's all.
Then if it doesn't affect Hebron, then what is the big deal? What is the big deal about letting them stay?
Because they're annoying and they give you this feeling, and they're always photographing you and photographing children and giving you this feeling. They're also a foreign intelligence service. They really are, by the way, all like FBI agents or police agents in their native countries. And there are snoopers, and you can feel these guys snooping around and looking at you.
And it's like, it's definitely a statement about your sovereignty.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's like, it's definitely saying, like, you need observation. You can't manage your situation on your own. You
right.
need somebody else to come in because you're like a suspicious entity who can't be trusted, and so you need to be observed.
Right. It doesn't feel right. It does not feel right. And it says something about the Jewish Israeli future in Hebron. Okay, it says it's in doubt now that they're gone. And now
also
that,
I want to say I think it's just good for the universe in the sense that these people's, it was like a humongous waste of money.
But they were making big money.
How?
They were
fundraising on it.
No, I don't know. I don't know if they were fundraising. These TIFF soldiers or observers were getting paid a ton of money. Like $20,000 a month.
What? I want to work for TIFF. Wait, don't close it. Don't close it.
Yeah,
they were. I want to go work for it.
And maybe it was $10,000 a month, but like they were, you know, they were coming out with a good old happy salary,
a hunk of change. Wow. Yeah.
So
it's a cushy job.
Yeah, it was a cushy job walking around, and
you'll have to go get a real job.
And all you have to do is like put on a scowl for like 10 hours. That's all you have to do is like your baby.
And look at Jewish women like they're like
right, like just and just
suspicious
be like
people.
Right. And so that's not even hard. It's not like the Jews are going to do anything to you. So you just make that like angry, you know, ticked off face. Like they weren't even all like that. Some of them were like, I'm not ticked off, and I don't really know what's going on here. I don't really care. I'm going to be here for a year, eat some malawach, and I'm out of here. Like the truth of the matter is, I had a few run-ins with them. They were just annoying more than anything. They were so that's why this whole thing is like. But it also did send a signal, and the signal, along with the ouster, well, that's not exactly the correct term, with leaving UNESCO because of the anti-Hebron decision. Together with that and the triumvirate, the trifecta, which is that there's been some building that has been approved. So bye-bye UNESCO, bye-bye TIFF, hello building, signaling that Israel is deciding that we're going to stay and build in Hebron, which is the most organic and natural thing that could happen.
So it's sort of like reasserting sovereignty, Jewish sovereignty. Israeli sovereignty is the more appropriate
yes.
word.
And it's
Israeli
making,
sovereignty over Hebron.
And it's making a statement. It's not making a statement at all, which is, okay, we went down that path, and we went down two paths, the path of Oslo and giving away the land to a different sovereign, and we went down the path of trusting the internationals. And now we've realized that
can't
they're
do
bunk.
That. Right.
Both of those groups, they're bunk. But, you know, Malka, the war is not over because, and there's really no amnesty, is there? There's just no amnesty because, or what I like to call Dishonesty International. That's what I call them. You like that? Dishonesty
yeah,
International? So Dishonesty International, they're onto it. And here's what they're calling for, as far as I understand. They're calling for a boycott of Judea and Samaria and tourism.
Okay. Here's the story. Amnesty International, that's who you were referring to.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to say before
Dastardly,
I get into this story. Amnesty International is calling.
I want a hashtag, okay, of a funny way to call Amnesty International. Hmm. I've come up
we'll
with Dishonesty International and Dastardly International.
That's funny. Okay, so basically the story is that Amnesty International, which is this big international human rights organization supposedly, is calling on online tourism companies to delist Jewish properties in Judea and Samaria. They created this study. It's called Destination Occupation.
Occupation Destination.
And they are asking or urging Airbnb, Booking.com, TripAdvisor, and Expedia to all erase the Jewish listings, activities, attractions, and accommodations from their sites located in Judea, Samaria, and Eastern Jerusalem. Here's some of the quotes. In doing business with settlements, all four companies are contributing to and profiting from the maintenance, development, and expansion of illegal settlements.
The occupying
which
power.
Amount to war crimes.
War crimes.
Under
apartheid.
International criminal law.
That is horrible. You know, and I think of myself as a good person. You know? Say that again. Can you just say that again?
You are an international criminally war crimer who lives in an illegal settlement.
Dang.
That's who you are.
Internationally?
Now, I want to talk now, and they say more and more of this. To boost bookings, many listings and settlements boast of their proximity to areas of natural beauty in the occupied territories, such as the Dead Sea, nature reserves, and the desert. By listing and promoting these natural features and nature-based activities and attractions, the digital companies are increasing the attractiveness of the listings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so far so good, yes.
Right.
Securing greater number of tourists and ultimately benefiting financially from the illegal exploitation of Palestinian natural resources.
Nice, nice.
And because of this, they want a boycott on Judea, Samaria, and Eastern Jerusalem. I just want to say something for a second. The BDS thing, boycott, divest, and sanction thing, is a very big thing, right? These days, it's like way cool to talk about boycotting, divesting, and sanctioning Israel, which is so ironic, right? Because the entire world is farther away from boycotting, divesting, and sanctioning Israel than they have ever been. Everyone wants to party with Aretha. Okay. Everybody wants to invest in Israel, get stuff from Israel, build some kind of high tech thing
in
Israel.
And tour Israel.
It was a record tourism year.
Right.
So the whole world is like not beperic. You know what I mean? They're not like trying to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel at all. So what are the smart people over at BDS doing in their minimalist offices over in somewhere? They're getting together and they're saying, how can we actually boycott, divest, and sanction Israel? Because you can't do it anymore. No one wants to divest from Israel. So they say, okay, what are we going to do? We're just going to carve it into pieces. Now, there's no way we can get people to really boycott Israel. That's impossible. If you want to survive an illness, if you want to use a computer, if you want to do any kind of normal thing on this planet, Israel's going to be a piece of your puzzle of doing that thing today. Baruch Hashem. I'm very proud of that. But they say, okay, so how can we get people to boycott? We'll just carve out this part, the Judea, Samaria, and Eastern Jerusalem part. There's not as much high tech in Judea and Samaria. There's not as much big factories in Judea and Samaria, and they're trying to get people to make sure that they don't build any factories. And what is like the cute, lucrative business that's going on in Judea and Samaria? It's these homes, the listings, the tourism, because people come out, they actually want to see this for themselves. They want to see what is this Judea, Samaria, and Eastern Jerusalem.
But there's also one big one, which is the Dead Sea.
Right,
So I heard some Israeli being like, wait a minute, the hotels are not like in the West Bank. Because if you check out the map, you'll see that the Ein Bokeh hotel area.
That hotel zone by the Dead Sea.
Is not in the West Bank, but isn't
so
regular,
ridiculous.
I'm like, do not be such a sissy and answer them. Be like, wait, the hotels are not in Judea and Samaria.
What? It's all the same.
Well, here's the point. What you're trying to say is, in other words, let's be real. What are we talking about here?
Anyone who's driven those roads knows this is the same thing.
No, but let's be realer than that. You said it. This is just a way to boycott Israel. They're against Israel.
Right. And they try to make you think that they're boycotting Judea, Samaria, and Eastern Jerusalem, when really, if they could, they would just boycott the whole thing, but they can't do it.
Right. So that's what this is really about. It's really about a way to – let's put it really, really dumbly, simply, that everybody can understand it. Amnesty International is against Israel.
Yes.
That's basically it, right? They are the front. They're the legitimate front for the jihad, and the way that they do it is with a thin veneer of rights, liberties for so-called Palestinians, and that's what they're all about. And that's really the name of the game today. It's a front. It's such a front. It's such a see-through front. But they use these fancy words, and that goes back to our story, Malka, which is that Israel's sending a signal, which is we're done with you, internationals. We're done with your prestiges and your powers and your all these things. You're not valuable anymore. We see that now.
So after this Amnesty International little report that they wrote up, Israel is already starting to look into getting rid of Amnesty International out of Israel as well. I'm not so up on what Amnesty International actually does in Israel, except for look in the yellow pages for
Sweetie,
stuff to boycott.
Annoying is a crime, okay? These guys are annoying. They got to go because they're annoying. They're
Minister of Internal Security and Strategic Affairs,
like
Gilad Erdan, is already investigating ways to get rid of Amnesty International.
That's right. Gilad Erdan,
and I
want to
say
BDS.
Something. I want to thank America for being so nutbags. I think that America and its crazy political situation today has really opened up the door for Israel to think a little bit more outside the box about how it handles external powers that it doesn't like. Sometimes I
don't understand what you're saying.
What I'm saying is that the current administration in the United States is such a public, is so talked about and discussed throughout the world. And the way that the administration handles things in a very, surprisingly undiplomatic way, and yet a pretty effective way in so many ways, I think has really made Israel kind of like take a step back and say, Israel is a country that up until now has been like, I would say, obsessed with diplomacy to an unhealthy degree. Israel has always tried to look a very certain way to a very certain kind of people, namely Europeans and Americans, and to look very acceptable and to never do anything which is going to be perceived in any way as somehow questionable or overly flexing of muscle, because we know that once we flex the muscle that all these countries are going to come down hard on us, and then they're going to make all kinds of other things more uncomfortable for us. So now you have this American administration, which happens to not put pressure on Israel about things, and in fact backs Israel up in a like maybe unprecedented way, but also the way that it handles its own internal issues, which is like very questionable to some people, at the same time is a very eye-opening way of dealing with things, and I think has made Israel realize that the doing the very, very, very most acceptable, most diplomatic thing is not always in its best interest, and we don't always have to do that.
By the way, speaking of diplomacy, there's a very non-diplomatic way of judging Israel, and that is its successes. I'm not always the one to talk about it.
But why is that not diplomatic?
It's not about diplomacy. Oh, it's right. Just about money, you know, and it's about success. And there's a humongous piece of news today about the Intel plant that Intel is about to put in. What is it? $10 billion.
$11 billion, I think, into Kiryat Gat.
Yeah, that's
which is pretty amazing. It's going to make,
and they he was
the truth is that I saw this piece of news, and because I care about the Intel investing in Israel, we should have bought stock in that years ago. But anyway, I happen to know that. That this was not a plan that was announced today, but was under investigation for many, many months now, that it was something that Intel had already raised because it was pouring some money into some other plant. And now it's decided to go forward with these plans, partially because Israel gives them a big, a matching.
They're going to be built on the 7-nanometer platform.
What is that? What does that mean? I don't even know what the words are that
virus.
You just said.
Yes. An Ebola virus. I heard it from the one of the Intel people today. Like an Ebola virus is about 900 nanometers, like one virus strain.
Oh, like a strand.
They're going to be working on parts in ships that are at the 7-nanometer level.
What do those do? What do those little guys do?
Dude, man, they make.
What is it like a brain? Are they creating brains?
They're making awesome.
I'm uncomfortable. I get nervous about all the future of technology a little bit sometimes. Do you ever get that?
like watching movies about that stuff, but
that stuff scares me.
I'm just excited to have the latest thing.
Anyway, the point is, it's going to be practically impossible to boycott Israel. Here's the like example number 11 billion. Why it's going to be so hard?
I don't think that's the point. Like that, you can't boycott. The point is, it's not being boycotted. It's definitely not.
But the point is that Israel is the kind of place that it's like, what do you mean? It's like boycotting oxygen. Like, you cannot do that.
Right, but even
you
more so, it's like that. But even that discussion is like a secondary discussion. The real main thing is, not only is it not being boycotted, but it's being built on a massive level. And there's nothing like that. There's no Intel plant in Syria.
Right? Well, you know what I mean? Not today.
They're just not doing that. That's not what's going on over there. And that's another thing. When I was a kid, Syria and Egypt were these serious, serious countries that you like took seriously. And I remember when I was in the army, even in 95-96, we were always talking about Syrian weapons and Egyptian weapons, Syrian pita, you know, all kinds of stuff like that.
Syrian pita?
Yeah.
Is that a euphemism for something?
It's a formation where
how
they
hit their
tanks.
I thought maybe
it
was a good bread.
No, they do have Syrian pita, Syrian za'atar and all that. But the bottom line is, like, not only, and this is what I say to my Arab interlocutors all the time. I say to them, what is it that you're wasting your time for? Don't you see that your whole civilization is in the toilet right now? Don't you see that? I tell them straight. And you know why? Not because Israel, because you hate us. It's because you hate. You got a hate problem.
You got a little international anger management class.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
We should call it Anger Management International.
And all this amnesty does
nothing.
Blink. Okay. What are they doing for the Arab societies? Nothing. Nothing. They do nothing for them. Are they raising them up? Are they helping them? Who's going to help the Arabs come out of this dark ages that they're in? Freaking Amnesty International? No. The only people that have a chance to help our cousins move up ahead is, you guessed it, Israel, the big brother, the younger brother, whatever, however you want to put it, okay? And amnesty, if I was an Arab, I would chuck these amnesties on their rear end, get out of here, don't let the door hit you on the way out. What do you have to give us with your fomenting of your Nazi-style European hate of Israel that you're using us as a front for? What has that brought you? Nothing. Nothing. And all these Arabs that get money from fighting with Israel, are they living a good life? Are their children heading in any good direction? What do they get from it? Nothing. So the whole point, I'm just trying to say that there's no future in this. And when you look behind the scenes, there was a Saudi blogger this week, or some Saudi journalist was like, it's time for us to accept Israel. It's a reality here, et cetera, et cetera. It's time for the Arabs to like snap out of it. You're not getting us out of these places, and you're not getting us out of Israel. And the more you try, the more you're going in the toilet. So why don't you just skip it, face the music, accept it, understand that Allah wills it, find a little Quranic verse that will make it okay, and just go on your merry way accepting your cousins in the middle of what you consider your region, and we could all live happily ever after. But they're just not in that zone right now. So that's just dumb. What can I tell you? It's like a wrong choice. Bad choice. You're not thinking with your good head. You're thinking with something that is just leading you down the path of self-destruction and hell. So that's what I want to say about that. Okay?
Very good.
Yes. Speaking of going down a path.
Yes.
A great rabbi was in town,
yes.
Rabbi Laser Brody.
Rabbi Laser Brody.
Yeah, he was in town?
Yeah, was in town. I had a nice Shabbat this last Shabbat. Rabbi Laser Brody came to the Shlomo Katz Synagogue. So for those of you who like music, we got Shlomo Katz, who is a pretty famous Jewish musician. And then he has a synagogue. He's like the rabbi of a small community here in Efrat. And to his synagogue was invited Rabbi Laser Brody, who has a pretty well-known blog called Laser Beams. He at least was a broadcaster on Israel National Radio back in the day with you and I, Ishai. And he also is like the right-hand man of Rabbi Shalom Arush, who is a very famous author and spiritual leader here in Israel from the Breslov sect. And he wrote a ton of books called The Garden of Emunah, The Garden of Faith, The Garden of Healing, The Garden of Peace, all these different books about how to kind of attain happiness, like really incredible levels of happiness in your life through primarily through being grateful for what you have and who you have. And, you know, there's whole books written on it, so I can't on one leg say everything about it, but basically about being grateful and serving Hashem in joy and seeing miracles in your life simply through being grateful to Hashem.
Right.
And Rabbi Laser is the English translator for Rabbi Arush. Rabbi Arush is a Hebrew speaker. He writes his books in Hebrew.
And a thinker.
And Rabbi Brody translates these, and he gives weekly lectures, and he puts those up on his blog. And he and Rav Arush travel around the world, certainly throughout the United States and Canada, talking to Jewish communities and inspiring them. And so, and we happen to know him personally, thankfully, through our experiences in the radio. And it was such an incredible joy for me to see him, because I watch his videos sometimes and like listen to them, kind of watch them while I'm making Shabbat food, on Fridays. And sometimes when I need a boost of any kind, I put on Rabbi Brody, and sometimes when I'm feeling down or feeling like I need to reconnect spiritually, I'll pick up the Garden of Emunah or the Garden of Gratitude and kind of lift myself back up out of whatever kind of hole I find myself in. So I have tremendous, tremendous gratitude to Rabbi Brody for everything that he's done for me through all the work that he does. And so it was a pleasure for me just to be in his presence. And then after Shabbat, Yosef Karduner, the famous Israeli singer, came and sang some of his beautiful, poignant hits. And it was just great. You know, to have a spiritual lift is, as they say in Hebrew, lo muvan me'elav. It's not something to be taken for granted, something to assume that will always happen. Life can be very gritty. Sometimes I can't believe how, these days I can't believe how fast the weeks go. I'm like in shock that it's, again, time to record this show and that it's going to be Shabbat again. I feel like I'm just like going from Shabbat food to Shabbat food to Shabbat food to Shabbat food, that the weeks are just flying, flying, flying. And so when you have a chance to connect to something that ignites you a little bit spiritually and raises you up and makes you remember your greater purpose and your greater worth and what you're doing here in this world, it's a big gift. So that happened to me. And I hope that there are some people out there who feel that way. I'm sure there are people, Yishai, who feel that way about your show, that it's a connection, a way to connect. You do your Torah with Rabbi Mike in the first half, and I'm sure it's very deep for people, and to know that they're getting Torah that's coming from Judea, that's coming from Jerusalem.
And then a little Malki.
Yeah, you got a little Malka making some jokes.
That's right, make the
being
jokes.
Being silly.
Yeah, people love it. People love it. They love
and
the
I hope
Malka.
That, I hope that, I hope
they
that
feel
it
like
raises
they're getting a full meal.
Also.
They feel like they're getting the meat and potatoes.
Yes.
With Rabbi Mike, and then they
the
get
little
the
Rice
apple
Krispie
pie
treats.
with the par of vanilla ice cream. That's you, Malka.
Thanks.
No problem. All right, Malka. Shabbat shalom. God bless you. Thank
Shabbat
you so
shalom.
Much. And Shabbat shalom to all of you out there. God bless you wherever you are. I want to thank Moshe Herman. I want to thank Ben Bresky. I want to thank Tabitha for doing a great job in getting this show out. You guys really, thanks so much for your teamwork. And all of us out there appreciate your work. I want to thank the good folks at Tchelet, T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T. I'm sporting
We ordered some tzitzit, Yishai.
I love it. It's one of the best mitzvot.
I'm excited that they're coming. I'm hoping that they're going to show up soon, maybe for Rosh Chodesh Adar.
Yes.
We'll pass them out around here in
That's
the house.
Right. So go check out the website and get yourself some True Blue Junus. That's going to be really fun. I also want to thank the good people at the Israel Bible that have a beautiful, beautiful Bible that they've created with a lot of with the focus on the land of Israel. This is a Bible that's good for all. It's just something great to own, and just check it out at the Israel Bible, theisraelbible.com. And I want to thank, of course, the Jewish community of Hebron. Come and visit us. Yerushalayim is number one, but then don't forget to visit number two. It's a day trip out of Jerusalem.
They're sister cities.
That's right, but it's a day trip out of Jerusalem. It's easy.
There's pizza there.
There's pizza. Come see the mothers and the fathers. eat the pizza in front of them.
I just want to say for
it gives them nachas.
I want to say, Yishai, that like Italian food is great. And I like Italian food. And it's one of the world's easiest foods to prepare in some of the dishes. But I wait for the day when the food that you eat in Hebron is not pizza.
Okay, Malika.
I just had to say that.
I'm working on it. I'm working on it. Right now, the pizza is better than
it's
ever been.
How about some of that Syrian pita that you were talking about
yeah,
before?
Yeah, they do have some good stuff. And they have good salads and great soup. There's great soup. That's right. David out in the Gutnick Center, right across from the Tomb of the Fathers and Mothers,
does a great job.
Yep, and maybe Shmuley Botech, maybe Roseanne will be there tomorrow.
Wow,
no promises.
No promises. Why they're going to sleep in?
Because they're Shmuley and Roseanne, and
they can do what they like,
and that's just the way they.
Well,
roll.
I hope they do come.
I'm happy that you hope so, and I hope so as well, and I hope that indeed hope and they're supposed to, but. We'll see. Anyway, it's going to be great. Maybe throw out a little happy prayer, but we're going to have a lot of fun. In any case, the mamas and the papas are waiting for you in Hebron. So check out HebronFund.org, which schedules those tours, weekly tours to Hebron in the English language. And we have more and more and more stuff happening there. That's it. I want to also thank our hosts here at thelandofisrael.com. I want to thank the Land of Israel for being our host here in the Land of Israel. Without even the .com, just plain old the Land of Israel.
The dirt our building is sitting in?
The Land of Israel.
It's one of the greatest privileges, Yishai, that a Jew has had in such an extremely long time.
That's right. That's right. It is a great privilege, and I want to thank the boss of this station and of the world, which is G-D, God Almighty. Thank you so much for everything that you've given us a chance to do. And as we always say, ten chalkeinu betoratecha, just give us a little sliver of a piece of action in your Torah and in your world. Your Torah is not just the book, it's also the life of Torah. Give us a chance to be part of it. And if you've listened to this part of the show, that means that you're a part of it. So send me hashtag I'm a part of it. And another way to be part of it, of course, is to donate and to help us keep doing the show. So check out YishaiFleischer.com or thelandofisrael.com and check out our flag project there and get yourself one of those flags. So there's a million ways to take part in the story. Another way of taking part of the story is going to rest so we can have a great next day. So it's time for us to rest, Malka.
I made chili for Shabbat, Yishai.
Are
you excited?
That.
I'm so glad to have announced that here on the show.
Oh, that is exciting.
I haven't made it in a really long time.
I love it. Are we going to have like tacos or what?
I wasn't thinking of tacos. I was just thinking of chili, some rice, maybe some green beans. Maybe I'll make some more of that chocolate popcorn I made this last Shabbat.
Yes, that was amazing. But maybe we should have some taco chips.
You want a little taco chips? Nacho chips?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You deserve it.
Little Tex-Mex. Yeah, that's good. that's why I married you, Tex. Okay. All right, folks. You are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Stay tuned. Stay strong. Stay connected. Be a part of it wherever you are. Lots of love from the Land of Israel and blessings from God Almighty, the forefathers and mothers that are waiting for you here, Hebron, Bethel, and, of course, the heart of it all, Yerushalayim. Shabbat shalom, everybody.
Shabbat shalom.
This week on Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston, an exclusive interview with Moshe Feiglin, head of the Zuhut Party.
I don't care who's going to be the prime minister that the Hamas will defeat next time. We get orders from all people who want some direction, who want real solutions for the economy.
That's Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston. Every Monday on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.